Strange to say, she was the first to have the poignant power, by merely not letting her smile fade, of burning a hole in my sleep and jolting me into clammy consciousness whenever I dreamed of her, although in real life I was even more afraid of being revolted by her dirt-caked feet and stale-smelling clothes than of insulting her by the triteness of quasi-senioral advances. 5. There are two especially vivid aspects of her that I would like to hold up simultaneously before my eyes in conclusion of her haunting image. The first lived for a long while within me, quite separately from the Polenka I associated with doorways and sunsets, as if I had glimpsed a nymphian incarnation of her pitiful beauty that were better left alone. One June day, the year when she and I were both 13, on the banks of the Oradesh, I was engaged in collecting some so-called Parnassians, Parnassius nemosyne to be exact, strange butterflies of ancient lineage, with rustling, glazed, semi-transparent wings, and catkin-like flossy abdomens. My quest had led me into a dense undergrowth of milky white racemosa and dark alder at the very edge of the cold blue river, when suddenly there was an outburst of splashes and shouts, and from behind a fragrant bush I caught sight of Polenka and three or four other naked children bathing from the ruins of an old bathhouse a few feet away. Wet, gasping, one nostril of her snub nose running, the ribs of her adolescent body arched under her pale, goose-pimpled skin, her calves flecked with black mud, a curved comb burning in her damp, darkened hair, she was scrambling away from the swish and clack of water lily stems that a drum-bellied girl with a shaven head and a shamelessly excited stripling wearing around the loins a kind of string locally used against the evil eye were yanking out of the water and harrying her with. And for a second or two, before I crept away in a dismal haze of disgust and desire, I saw a strange Polenka shiver and squat on the boards of the half-broken wharf, covering her breasts against the east wind with her crossed arms, while with the tip of her tongue she taunted her pursuers. The other picture refers to a Sunday at Christmastide in 1916. From the silent, snow-blanketed platform of the little station of Sivierski on the Warsaw Line, it was the nearest to our country place, I was watching a distant silvery grove as it changed to lead under the evening sky, and waiting for it to emit the dull violet smoke of the train that would take me back to St. Petersburg after a day of skiing. The smoke duly appeared, and at the same moment, she and another girl walked past me, heavily kerchiefed in huge felt boots and horrible, shapeless, long quilted jackets, with the stuffing showing at the torn spots of the coarse black cloth, and as she passed, Polenka, a bruise under her eye and a puffed-up lip, did her husband beat her on Saturdays, remarked in wistful and melodious tones to nobody in particular, "A barchuk to menya na prizna. Look, the young master does not know me." And that was the only time I ever heard her speak. 6. The summer evenings of my boyhood when I used to ride by her cottage speak to me in that voice of hers now. On a road among fields where it met the desolate highway, I would dismount and prop my bicycle against a telegraph pole. A sunset, almost formidable in its splendor, would be lingering in the fully exposed sky. Among its imperceptibly changing amassments, one could pick out brightly stained structural details of celestial organisms, or glowing slits in dark banks, or flat ethereal beaches that looked like mirages of desert islands. I did not know then, as I know perfectly well now, what to do with such things, how to get rid of them, how to transform them into something that can be turned over to the reader in printed characters to have him cope with the blessed shiver. And this inability enhanced my oppression. A colossal shadow would begin to invade the fields, and the telegraph poles hummed in the stillness, and the night feeders ascended the stems of their plants. Nibble, 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 went a handsome striped caterpillar, not figured in Spuler, as he clung to a campanula stalk, working down with his mandibles along the edge of the nearest leaf out of which he was eating a leisurely hemicircle, then again extending his neck, and again bending it gradually as he deepened the neat concave. Automatically, I might slip him, with a bit of his plantlet, into a matchbox to take home with me, and have him produce next year a splendid surprise. But my thoughts were elsewhere. Zina and Colette, my seaside playmates. Louise the Prancer. All the flushed, low-sashed, silky-haired little girls at festive parties. Languorous Countess G, my cousin's lady. Polenka, smiling in the agony of my new dreams. All would merge to form somebody I did not know, but was bound to know soon. I recall one particular sunset. It lent an ember to my bicycle bell. Overhead, above the black music of telegraph wires, a number of long, dark violet clouds lined with flamingo pink hung motionless in a fan-shaped arrangement. The whole thing was like some prodigious ovation in terms of color and form. It was dying, however, and everything else was darkening, too. But just above the horizon, in a lucid turquoise space, beneath the black stratus, the eye found a vista that only a fool could mistake for the spare parts of this or any other sunset. It occupied a very small sector of the enormous sky, and had the peculiar neatness of something seen through the wrong end of a telescope. There it lay in wait, a family of serene clouds in miniature, an accumulation of brilliant convolutions, anachronistic in their creaminess and extremely remote. Remote, but perfect in every detail. Fantastically reduced, but faultlessly shaped. My marvelous tomorrow, ready to be delivered to me. Chapter 11 1 In order to reconstruct the summer of 1914, when the numb fury of verse-making first came over me, all I really need is to visualize a certain pavilion. There, the lank 15-year-old lad I then was sought shelter during a thunderstorm, of which there was an inordinate number that July. I dream of my pavilion at least twice a year. As a rule, it appears in my dreams quite independently of their subject matter, which of course may be anything from abduction to zoolatry. It hangs around, so to speak, with the unobtrusiveness of an artist's signature. I find it clinging to a corner of the dream canvas, or cunningly worked into some ornamental part of the picture. At times, however, it seems to be suspended in the middle distance, a trifle baroque, and yet in tune with the handsome trees, dark fir and bright birch, whose sap once ran through its timber. Wine red and bottle green and dark blue lozenges of stained glass lend a chapel-like touch to the lattice work of its casements. It is just as it was in my boyhood, a sturdy old wooden structure above a ferny ravine in the older riverside part of our Vera Park. Just as it was, or perhaps a little more perfect. In the real thing, some of the glass was missing. Crumpled leaves had been swept in by the wind. The narrow little bridge that arched across the gill at its deepest part, with the pavilion rising midway like a coagulated rainbow, was as slippery after a rainy spell as if it had been coated with some dark and, in a sense, magic ointment. Etymologically, pavilion and papilio are closely related. Inside, there was nothing in the way of furniture except a folding table hinged rustily to a wall under the east window, through the two or three glassless or pale-glassed compartments of which, among the bloated blues and drunken reds, one could catch a glimpse of the river. On a floorboard at my feet, a dead horsefly lay on its back near the brown remains of a birch ammet, and the patches of disintegrating whitewash on the inside of the door had been used by various trespassers for such jottings as, "Dasha, Tamara, and Lena have been here," or "Down with Austria." The storm passed quickly. The rain, which had been a mass of violently descending water wherein the trees writhed and rolled, was reduced all at once to oblique lines of silent gold breaking into short and long dashes against a background of subsiding vegetable agitation. Gulfs of voluptuous blue were expanding between great clouds, heap upon heap of pure white and purplish gray. Lepota, old Russian for stately beauty, moving mists, gouache and guano, among the curves of which one could distinguish a mammary illusion or the death mask of a poet. The tennis court was a region of great lakes. Beyond the park, above steaming fields, a rainbow slipped into view. The fields ended in the notched dark border of a remote fir wood. Part of the rainbow went across it, and that section of the forest edge shimmered most magically through the pale green and pink of the iridescent veil drawn before it. A tenderness and a glory that made poor relatives of the rhomboidal colored reflections which the return of the sun had brought forth on the pavilion floor. A moment later, my first poem began. What touched it off? I think I know. Without any wind blowing, the sheer weight of a raindrop, shining in parasitic luxury on a cordate leaf, caused its tip to dip, and what looked like a globule of quicksilver performed a sudden glissando down the center vein, and then, having shed its bright load, the relieved leaf unbent. Tip, leaf, dip, relief. The instant it all took to happen seemed to me not so much a fraction of time as a fissure in it, a missed heartbeat, which was refunded at once by a patter of rhymes. I say patter intentionally, for when a gust of wind did come, the trees would briskly start to drip all together in as crude an imitation of the recent downpour as the stanza I was already muttering resembled the shock of wonder I had experienced when for a moment heart and leaf had been one. 2. In the avid heat of the early afternoon, benches, bridges, and bowls, all things, in fact, save the tennis court, were drying with incredible rapidity, and soon little remained of my initial inspiration. Although the bright fissure had closed, I doggedly went on composing. My medium happened to be Russian, but could have been just as well Ukrainian or basic English or Volapük. The kind of poem I produced in those days was hardly anything more than a sign I made of being alive, of passing or having passed or hoping to pass through certain intense human emotions. It was a phenomenon of orientation rather than of art, thus comparable to stripes of paint on a roadside rock or to a pillared heap of stones marking a mountain trail. But then, in a sense, all poetry is positional. To try to express one's position in regard to the universe embraced by consciousness is an immemorial urge. The arms of consciousness reach out and grope, and the longer they are, the better. Tentacles, not wings, are Apollo's natural members. Vivian Bloodmark, a philosophical friend of mine in later years, used to say that while the scientist sees everything that happens in one point of space, the poet feels everything that happens in one point of time. Lost in thought, he taps his knee with his wand-like pencil, and at the same instant a car, New York license plate, passes along the road. A child bangs the screen door of a neighboring porch, an old man yawns in a misty Turkestan orchard, a granule of cinder-gray sand is rolled by the wind on Venus, a Dr. Jacques Hirsch in Grenoble puts on his reading glasses, and trillions of other such trifles occur, all forming an instantaneous and transparent organism of events, of which the poet, sitting in a lawn chair at Ithaca, New York, is the nucleus. That summer I was still far too young to evolve any wealth of cosmic synchronization, to quote my philosopher again. But I did discover, at least, that a person hoping to become a poet must have the capacity of thinking of several things at a time. In the course of the languid rambles that accompanied the making of my first poem, I ran into the village schoolmaster, an ardent socialist, a good man, intensely devoted to my father. I welcome this image again. Always with a tight posy of wildflowers, always smiling, always perspiring. While politely discussing with him my father's sudden journey to town, I registered simultaneously and with equal clarity not only his wilting flowers, his flowing tie, and the blackheads on the fleshy volutes of his nostrils, but also the dull little voice of a cuckoo coming from afar, and the flash of a Queen of Spain settling on the road, and the remembered impression of the pictures, enlarged agricultural pests and bearded Russian writers in the well-aerated classrooms of the village school which I had once or twice visited. And to continue a tabulation that hardly does justice to the ethereal simplicity of the whole process, the throb of some utterly irrelevant recollection, A pedometer I had lost was released from a neighboring brain cell, and the savor of the grass stalk I was chewing mingled with the cuckoo's note and the fritillary's takeoff, and all the while I was richly, serenely aware of my own manifold awareness. He beamed, and he bowed, in the effusive manner of a Russian radical, and took a couple of steps backward, and turned, and jauntily went on his way, and I picked up the thread of my poem. During the short time I had been otherwise engaged, something seemed to have happened to such words as I had already strung together. They did not look quite as lustrous as they had before the interruption. Some suspicion crossed my mind that I might be dealing in dummies. Fortunately, this cold twinkle of critical perception did not last. The fervor I had been trying to render took over again and brought its medium back to an illusory life. The ranks of words I reviewed were again so glowing with their puffed-out little chests and trim uniforms that I put down to mere fancy the sagging I had noticed out of the corner of my eye. 3. Apart from credulous inexperience, a young Russian versificator had to cope with a special handicap. In contrast to the rich vocabulary of satirical or narrative verse, the Russian elegy suffered from a bad case of verbal anemia. Only in very expert hands could it be made to transcend its humble origin, the pallid poetry of 18th-century France. True, in my day a new school was in the act of ripping up the old rhythms, but it was still to the latter that the conservative beginner turned in search of a neutral instrument, possibly because he did not wish to be diverted from the simple expression of simple emotions by adventures in hazardous form. Form, however, got its revenge. The rather monotonous designs into which early 19th-century Russian poets had twisted the pliant elegy resulted in certain words or types of words, such as the Russian equivalents of fol amour or langoureux et rêvant, being coupled again and again, and this later lyricists could not shake off for a whole century. In an especially obsessive arrangement, peculiar to the iambic of 4 to 6 feet, a long, wriggly adjective would occupy the first 4 or 5 syllables of the last 3 feet of the line. A good tetrametric example would be terpi bezchilenie muki, endure incalculable torments. The young Russian poet was liable to slide with fatal ease into this alluring abyss of syllables, for the illustration of which I have chosen bezchilenie only because it translates well. The real favorites were such typical elegiac components as zadumchivye, pensive, utrachenye, lost, muchitelnye, anguished, and so forth, all accented on the second syllable. Despite its great length, a word of that kind had but a single accent of its own, and consequently the penultimate metrical stress of the line encountered a normally unstressed syllable, ni in the Russian example, la in the English one. This produced a pleasant scud, which, however, was much too familiar an effect to redeem banality of meaning. An innocent beginner, I fell into all the traps laid by the singing epithet. Not that I did not struggle. In fact, I was working at my elegy very hard, taking endless trouble over every line, choosing and rejecting, rolling the words on my tongue with the glazed-eye solemnity of a tea-taster. And still it would come, that atrocious betrayal. The frame impelled the picture, the husk shaped the pulp. The hackneyed order of words, short verb or pronoun, long adjective, short noun, engendered the hackneyed disorder of thought, and some such line as poeta goresnye griozi, translatable and accented as the poet's melancholy daydreams, led fatally to a rhyming line ending in rosy, roses, or beriozy, birches, or grozy, thunderstorms, so that certain emotions were connected with certain surroundings not by a free act of one's will, but by the faded ribbon of tradition. Nonetheless, the nearer my poem got to its completion, the more certain I became that whatever I saw before me would be seen by others. as I focused my eyes upon a kidney-shaped flowerbed, and noted one pink petal lying on the loam and a small ant investigating its decayed edge, or considered the tanned midriff of a birch trunk where some hoodlum had stripped it of its papery pepper-and-salt bark, I really believed that all this would be perceived by the reader through the magic veil of my words, such as Uturachenye Rosi or Zadumchivoy Beryosi. It did not occur to me, then, that far from being a veil, those poor words were so opaque that in fact they formed a wall in which all one could distinguish were the well-worn bits of the major and minor poets I imitated. Years later, in the squalid suburb of a foreign town, I remember seeing a paling, the boards of which had been brought from some other place where they had been used, apparently, as the enclosure of an itinerant circus. Animals had been painted on it by a versatile barker. But whoever had removed the boards, and then knocked them together again, must have been blind or insane, for now the fence showed only disjointed parts of animals, some of them, moreover, upside down. A tawny haunch, a zebra's head, the leg of an elephant. 4. On the physical plane, my intense labors were marked by a number of dim actions or postures, such as walking, sitting, lying. Each of these broke again into fragments of no spatial importance. At the walking stage, for instance, I might be wandering one moment in the depths of the park, and the next pacing the rooms of the house. Or to take the sitting stage, I would suddenly become aware that a plate of something I could not even remember having sampled was being removed, and that my mother, her left cheek twitching as it did whenever she worried, was narrowly observing from her place at the top of the long table my moodiness and lack of appetite. I would lift my head to explain, but the table had gone, and I was sitting alone on a roadside stump, the stick of my butterfly net in metronomic motion, drawing arc after arc on the brownish sand. Earthen rainbows, with variations in depth of stroke, rendering the different colors. When I was irrevocably committed to finish my poem or die, there came the most trance-like state of all. With hardly a twinge of surprise, I found myself, of all places, on a leathern couch in the cold, musty, little-used room that had been my grandfather's study. On that couch I lay prone in a kind of reptilian freeze, one arm dangling, so that my knuckles loosely touched the floral figures of the carpet. When next I came out of that trance, the greenish flora was still there, my arm was still dangling, but now I was prostrate on the edge of a rickety wharf, and the water lilies I touched were real, and the undulating, plump shadows of alder foliage on the water, apotheosized ink blots, oversized amoebas, were rhythmically palpitating, extending and drawing in dark pseudopods which, when contracted, would break at their rounded margins into elusive and fluid macules, and these would come together again to reshape the groping terminals. I relapsed into my private mist, and when I emerged again, the support of my extended body had become a low bench in the park, and the live shadows among which my hand dipped now moved on the ground among violet tints instead of aqueous black and green. So little did ordinary measures of existence mean in that state that I would not have been surprised to come out of its tunnel right into the park of Versailles, or the Tiergarten, or Sequoia National Forest. And inversely, when the old trance occurs nowadays, I am quite prepared to find myself, when I awaken from it, high up in a certain tree, above the dappled bench of my boyhood, my belly pressed against a thick, comfortable branch, and one arm hanging down among the leaves upon which the shadows of other leaves move. Various sounds reached me in my various situations. It might be the dinner gong, or something less usual, such as the foul music of a barrel organ. Somewhere near the stables the old tramp would grind, and on the strength of more direct impressions imbibed in earlier years, I would see him mentally from my perch. Painted on the front of his instrument were Balkan peasants of sorts, dancing among palmoid willows. Every now and then he shifted the crank from one hand to the other. I saw the jersey and skirt of his little bald female monkey, her collar, the raw sore on her back, the chain which she kept plucking at every time the man pulled it, hurting her badly, and the several servants standing around, gaping, grinning, simple folks, terribly tickled by a monkey's antics. Only the other day, near the place where I am recording these matters, I came across a farmer and his son, the kind of keen, healthy kid you see in breakfast food ads, who were similarly diverted by the sight of a young cat torturing a baby chipmunk, letting him run a few inches and then pouncing upon him again. Most of his tail was gone, the stump was bleeding. As he could not escape by running, the game little fellow tried one last measure. He stopped and lay down on his side in order to merge with a bit of light and shade on the ground, but the too violent heaving of his flank gave him away. The family phonograph, which the advent of the evening set in action, was another musical machine I could hear through my verse. On the veranda where our relatives and friends assembled, it emitted from its brass mouthpiece the so-called Tsiganskie romanzi, beloved of my generation. These were more or less anonymous imitations of gypsy songs, or imitations of such imitations. What constituted their gypsiness was a deep, monotonous moan, broken by a kind of hiccup, the audible cracking of a lovesick heart. At their best, they were responsible for the raucous note vibrating here and there in the works of true poets. I am thinking especially of Alexander Bloch. At their worst, they could be likened to the apache stuff composed by mild men of letters and delivered by thick-set ladies in Parisian nightclubs. Their natural environment was characterized by nightingales in tears, lilacs in bloom, and the alleys of whispering trees that graced the parks of the landed gentry. Those nightingales trilled, and in a pine grove the setting sun banded the trunks at different levels with fiery red. A tambourine, still throbbing, seemed to lie on the darkening moss. For a spell, the last notes of the husky contralto pursued me through the dusk. When silence returned, my first poem was ready. 5. It was indeed a miserable concoction, containing many borrowings besides its pseudo-Pushkinian modulations. An echo of Tyutchev's thunder and a refracted sunbeam from Fet were alone excusable. For the rest, I vaguely remember the mention of memory's sting, Vospominania Jalo, which I had really visualized as the ovipositor of an ichneumon fly straddling a cabbage caterpillar, but had not dared say so, and something about the old-world charm of a distant barrel organ. Worst of all were the shameful gleanings from Aputin's and Grand Duke Constantine's lyrics of the Tsigansky type. They used to be persistently pressed upon me by a youngish and rather attractive aunt, who could also spout Louis Bouilliet's famous piece, A une femme, in which a metaphorical violin bow is incongruously used to play on a metaphorical guitar, and lots of stuff by Ella Wheeler Wilcox, a tremendous hit with the Empress and her ladies-in-waiting. It seems hardly worthwhile to add that, as themes go, my elegy dealt with the loss of a beloved mistress, Delia, Tamara, or Lenore, whom I had never lost, never loved, never met, but was all set to meet, love, lose. In my foolish innocence, I believed that what I had written was a beautiful and wonderful thing. As I carried it homeward, still unwritten, but so complete that even its punctuation marks were impressed on my brain like a pillow crease on a sleeper's flesh, I did not doubt that my mother would greet my achievement with glad tears of pride. The possibility of her being much too engrossed that particular night in other events to listen to verse did not enter my mind at all. Never in my life had I craved more for her praise. Never had I been more vulnerable. My nerves were on edge because of the darkness of the earth, which I had not noticed muffling itself up, and the nakedness of the firmament, the disrobing of which I had not noticed either. Overhead, between the formless trees bordering my dissolving path, the night sky was pale with stars. In those years, that marvelous mess of constellations, nebulae, interstellar gaps, and all the rest of the awesome show provoked in me an indescribable sense of nausea, of utter panic, as if I were hanging from Earth upside down on the brink of infinite space, with terrestrial gravity still holding me by the heels, but about to release me any moment. Except for two corner windows in the upper story, my mother's sitting room, the house was already dark. The night watchman let me in, and slowly, carefully, so as not to disturb the arrangement of words in my aching head, I mounted the stairs. My mother reclined on the sofa with a St. Petersburg Wretch in her hands and an unopened London Times in her lap. A white telephone gleamed on the glass-topped table near her. Late as it was, she still kept expecting my father to call from St. Petersburg, where he was being detained by the tension of approaching war. An armchair stood by the sofa, but I always avoided it because of its golden satin, the mere sight of which caused a lanciniate shiver to branch from my spine like nocturnal lightning. With a little cough, I sat down on a footstool and started my recitation. While thus engaged, I kept staring at the farther wall, upon which I see so clearly in retrospect some small daguerreotypes and silhouettes in oval frames, a Somoff aquarelle, young birch trees, the half of a rainbow, everything very melting and moist, a splendid Versailles autumn by Alexander Benois, and a crayon drawing my mother's mother had made in her girlhood, that park pavilion again with its pretty windows partly screened by linked branches. The Somoff and the Benois are now in some Soviet museum, but that pavilion will never be nationalized. As my memory hesitated for a moment on the threshold of the last stanza, where so many opening words had been tried that the finally selected one was now somewhat camouflaged by an array of false entrances, I heard my mother sniff. Presently I finished reciting and looked up at her. She was smiling ecstatically through the tears that streamed down her face. "How wonderful, how beautiful," she said, and with the tenderness in her smile still growing, she passed me a hand mirror so that I might see the smear of blood on my cheekbone where at some indeterminable time I had crushed a gorged mosquito by the unconscious act of propping my cheek on my fist. But I saw more than that. Looking into my own eyes, I had the shocking sensation of finding the mere dregs of my usual self, odds and ends of an evaporated identity, which it took my reason quite an effort to gather again in the glass. Chapter 12 1 When I first met Tamara, to give her a name concolorous with her real one, she was 15, and I was a year older. The place was the rugged but comely country, black fir, white birch, peat bogs, hay fields, and barrens, just south of St. Petersburg. A distant war was dragging on. 2 years later, that trite deus ex machina, the Russian Revolution, came, causing my removal from the unforgettable scenery. In fact, already then, in July 1915, dim omens and backstage rumblings, the hot breath of fabulous upheavals, were affecting the so-called symbolist school of Russian poetry, especially the verse of Alexander Blok. During the beginning of that summer and all through the previous one, Tamara's name had kept cropping up, with the feigned naivete so typical of fate when meaning business, here and there on our estate, entry forbidden, and on my uncle's land, entry strictly forbidden, on the opposite bank of the Oradesh. I would find it written with a stick on the reddish sand of a park avenue, or penciled on a whitewashed wicket, or freshly carved, but not completed, in the wood of some ancient bench, as if Mother Nature were giving me mysterious advance notices of Tamara's existence. That hushed July afternoon when I discovered her standing quite still, only her eyes were moving, in a birch grove, she seemed to have been spontaneously generated there among those watchful trees with the silent completeness of a mythological manifestation. She slapped dead the horsefly that she had been waiting for to light and proceeded to catch up with two other, less pretty girls who were calling to her. Presently, from a vantage point above the river, I saw them walking over the bridge, clicking along on brisk high heels, all three with their hands tucked into the pockets of their navy blue jackets, and because of the flies, every now and then tossing their beribboned and beflowered heads. Very soon I traced Tamara to the modest dachka, summer cottage that her family rented in the village. I would ride my horse or my bicycle in the vicinity, and with a sudden sensation of a dazzling explosion, after which my heart would take quite a time to get back from where it had landed, I used to come across Tamara at this or that bland bend of the road. Mother Nature eliminated first one of her girl companions, then the other, but not until August 9, 1915, to be Petrarchically exact, at 4:30 of that season's fairest afternoon in the rainbow-windowed pavilion, that I had noticed my trespasser enter. Not until then did I muster sufficient courage to speak to her. Seen through the carefully wiped lenses of time, the beauty of her face is as near and glowing as ever. She was short and a trifle on the plump side, but very graceful, with her slim ankles and supple waist. A drop of Tatar or Circassian blood might have accounted for the slight slant of her merry dark eye and the duskiness of her blooming cheek. A light down, akin to that found on fruit of the almond group, lined her profile with a fine rim of radiance. She accused her rich brown hair of being unruly and oppressive, and threatened to have it bobbed, and did have it bobbed a year later, but I always recall it as it looked first, fiercely braided into a thick plait that was looped up at the back of her head, and tied there with a big bow of black silk. Her lovely neck was always bare, even in winter in St. Petersburg, for she had managed to obtain permission to eschew the stifling collar of a Russian schoolgirl's uniform. Whenever she made a funny remark or produced a jingle from her vast store of minor poetry, she had a most winning way of dilating her nostrils with a little snort of amusement. Still, I was never quite sure when she was serious and when she was not. The rippling of her ready laughter, her rapid speech, the roll of her very uvular R, the tender, moist gleam on her lower eyelid. Indeed, all her features were ecstatically fascinating to me, but somehow or other, instead of divulging her person, they tended to form a brilliant veil in which I got entangled every time I tried to learn more about her. When I used to tell her we would marry in the last days of 1917, as soon as I had finished school, she would quietly call me a fool. I visualized her home, but vaguely. Her mother's first name and patronymic, which were all I knew of the woman, had merchant class or clerical connotations. Her father, who I gathered took hardly any interest in his family, was the steward of a large estate somewhere in the south. Autumn came early that year. Layers of fallen leaves piled up ankle-deep by the end of August. Velvet-black Camberwell beauties with creamy borders sailed through the glades. The tutor to whose erratic care my brother and I were entrusted that season used to hide in the bushes in order to spy upon Tamara and me with the aid of an old telescope he had found in the attic. But in his turn, one day, the peeper was observed by my uncle's purple-nosed old gardener, Apostolsky, incidentally a great tumbler of weeding girls, who very kindly reported it to my mother. She could not tolerate snooping. And besides, though I never spoke to her about Tamara, she knew all she cared to know of my romance from my poems, which I recited to her in a spirit of praiseworthy objectivity, and which she lovingly copied out in a special album. My father was away with his regiment. He did feel it his duty, after acquainting himself with the stuff, to ask me some rather awkward questions when he returned from the front a month later. But my mother's purity of heart had carried her, and was to carry her, over worse difficulties. She contented herself with shaking her head dubiously, though not untenderly, and telling the butler to leave every night some fruit for me on the lighted veranda. I took my adorable girl to all those secret spots in the woods where I had daydreamed so ardently of meeting her, of creating her. In one particular pine grove, everything fell into place. I parted the fabric of fancy. I tasted reality. As my uncle was absent that year, we could also stray freely in his huge, dense, two-story old park, with its classical cripples of green-stained stone in the main avenue and labyrinthine paths radiating from a central fountain. We walked swinging hands, country fashion. I picked dahlias for her on the borders along the gravel drive, under the distant, benevolent eye of old Priapostolsky. We felt less safe when I used to see her home, or near home, or at least to the village bridge. I remember the coarse graffiti linking our first names in strange diminutives on a certain white gate, and a little apart from that village idiot scrawl, the adage, "Prudence is the friend of passion," in a bristly hand well known to me. Once, at sunset, near the Orange and Black River, a young Dutchnik, vacationist with a riding crop in his hand, bowed to her in passing, whereupon she blushed like a girl in a novel, but only said, with a spirited sneer, that he had never ridden a horse in his life. And another time, as we emerged onto a turn of the highway, my two little sisters, in their wild curiosity, almost fell out of the Red Family torpedo swerving toward the bridge. On dark, rainy evenings, I would load the lamp of my bicycle with magical lumps of calcium carbide, shield a match from the gusty wind, and having imprisoned a white flame in the glass, ride cautiously into the darkness. The circle of light cast by my lamp would pick out the damp, smooth shoulder of the road, between its central system of puddles and the long bordering grasses. Like a tottering ghost, the pale ray would weave across a clay bank at the turn as I began the downhill ride toward the river. Beyond the bridge, the road sloped up again to meet the Rojestvieno-Luga highway, and just above that junction, a footpath among dripping jasmine bushes ascended a steep escarpment. I had to dismount and push my bicycle. As I reached the top, my livid light flitted across the six-pillared white portico at the back of my uncle's mute, shuttered manor, as mute and shuttered as it may be today, half a century later. There, in a corner of that arched shelter from where she had been following the zigzags of my ascending light, Tamara would be waiting, perched on the broad parapet with her back to a pillar. I would put out my lamp and grope my way toward her. One is moved to speak more eloquently about these things, about many other things that one always hopes might survive captivity in the zoo of words, but the ancient limes crowding close to the house drown Mnemosyne's monologue with their creaking and heaving in the restless night. Their sigh would subside. The rainpipe at one side of the porch, a small busybody of water, could be heard steadily bubbling. At times, some additional rustle, troubling the rhythm of the rain and the leaves, would cause Tamara to turn her head in the direction of an imagined footfall, and then by a faint luminosity, now rising above the horizon of my memory despite all that rain, I could distinguish the outline of her face. But there was nothing and nobody to fear, and presently she would gently exhale the breath she had held for a moment, and her eyes would close again. 2. With the coming of winter, our reckless romance was transplanted to grim St. Petersburg. We found ourselves horribly deprived of the sylvan security we had grown accustomed to. Hotels disreputable enough to admit us stood beyond the limits of our daring, and the great era of parked amours was still remote. The secrecy that had been so pleasurable in the country now became a burden, yet neither of us could face the notion of chaperoned meetings at her home or mine. Consequently, we were forced to wander a good deal about the town, she in her little gray furred coat, I white-spatted and caracal-collared, with a knuckle-duster in my velvet-lined pocket. And this permanent quest for some kind of refuge produced an odd sense of hopelessness, which in its turn foreshadowed other, much later and lonelier, roamings. We skipped school. I forget what Tamara's procedure was. Mine consisted of talking either of the two chauffeurs into dropping me at this or that corner on the way to school. Both were good sports and actually refused to accept my gold, handy 5-ruble pieces coming from the bank in appetizing, weighty sausages of 10 or 20 shining pieces, in the aesthetic recollection of which I can freely indulge now that my proud émigré destitution is also a thing of the past. Nor had I any trouble with our wonderful, eminently bribable Ustin, who took the calls on our ground-floor telephone, the number of which was 2443, 2443. He briskly replied I had a sore throat. I wonder, by the way, what would happen if I put in a long-distance call from my desk right now. No answer. No such number, no such country. or the voice of Ustin saying, Moyo pochtenietse, the ingratiating diminutive of my respects. There exist, after all, well-publicized Slavs and Kurds who are well over 150. My father's telephone in his study, 58451, was not listed, and my form master, in his attempts to learn the truth about my failing health, never got anywhere, though sometimes I missed 3 days in a row. We walked under the white lacery of berimed avenues in public parks. We huddled together on cold benches, after having removed first their tidy cover of snow, then our snow-encrusted mittens. We haunted museums. They were drowsy and deserted on weekday mornings, and very warm, in contrast to the glacial haze and its red sun that, like a flushed moon, hung in the eastern windows. There we would seek the quiet back rooms, the stopgap mythologies nobody looked at, the etchings, the medals, the paleographic items, the story of printing, poor things like that. Our best find, I think, was a small room where brooms and ladders were kept, but a batch of empty frames that suddenly started to slide and topple in the dark attracted an inquisitive art lover, and we fled. The Hermitage, St. Petersburg's Louvre, offered nice nooks, especially in a certain hall on the ground floor among cabinets with scarabs, behind the sarcophagus of Nana, High Priest of Ptah, in the Russian Museum of Emperor Alexander III, two halls, numbers 30 and 31, in its northeastern corner, harboring repellently academic paintings by Shishkin, clearing in a pine forest, and by Harlamov, head of a young gypsy, offered a bit of privacy because of some tall stands with drawings, until a foul-mouthed veteran of the Turkish campaign threatened to call the police. So from these great museums, we graduated to smaller ones, such as the Suvorov, for instance, where I recall a most silent room full of old armor and tapestries and torn silk banners, with several bewigged, heavily booted dummies in green uniforms standing guard over us. But wherever we went, invariably after a few visits, this or that hoary, bleary-eyed, felt-soled attendant would grow suspicious, and we would have to transfer our furtive frenzy elsewhere, to the Pedagogical Museum, to the Museum of Court Carriages, or to a tiny museum of old maps, which guidebooks do not even list, and then out again into the cold, into some lane of great gates and green lions with rings in their jaws, into the stylized snowscape of the art world, Mir Iskustva, Dobuzhinsky, Alexander Benoit, so dear to me in those days. On late afternoons, we got into the last row of seats in one of the two movie theaters, the Parisiana and the Piccadilly on Nevsky Avenue. The art was progressing. Sea waves were tinted a sickly blue, and as they rode in and burst into foam against the black, remembered rock, Rocher de la Vierge, Biarritz, funny, I thought, to see again the beach of my cosmopolitan childhood, there was a special machine that imitated the sound of the surf, making a kind of washy swish that never quite managed to stop short with the scene, but for 3 or 4 seconds accompanied the next feature, a brisk funeral, say, or shabby prisoners of war with their dapper captors. As often as not, the title of the main picture was a quotation from some popular poem or song, and might be quite long-winded, such as "The chrysanthemums blossom no more in the garden," or "Her heart was a toy in his hands, and like a toy it got broken." Female stars had low foreheads, magnificent eyebrows, lavishly shaded eyes. The favorite actor of the day was Mozhugin. One famous director had acquired in the Moscow countryside a white-pillared mansion, not unlike that of my uncle, and it appeared in all the pictures he made. Mozhugin would drive up to it in a smart sleigh and fix a steely eye on a light in one window, while a celebrated little muscle twitched under the tight skin of his jaw. When museums and movie houses failed us and the night was young, we were reduced to exploring the wilderness of the world's most gaunt and enigmatic city. Solitary street lamps were metamorphosed into sea creatures with prismatic spines by the icy moisture on our eyelashes. As we crossed the vast squares, various architectural phantoms arose with silent suddenness right before us. We felt a cold chill, generally associated not with height but with depth, with an abyss opening at one's feet, when great monolithic pillars of polished granite, polished by slaves, repolished by the moon, and rotating smoothly in the polished vacuum of the night, zoomed above us to support the mysterious rotundities of St. Isaac's Cathedral. We stopped on the brink, as it were, of these perilous massifs of stone and metal, and with linked hands, in Lilliputian awe, craned our heads to watch new colossal visions rise in our way. The 10 glossy gray atlante of a palace portico, or a giant vase of porphyry near the iron gate of a garden, or that enormous column with a black angel on its summit that obsessed, rather than adorned, the moon-flooded palace square, and went up and up, trying in vain to reach the sub-base of Pushkin's Exegi Monumentum. She contended afterward, in her rare moments of moodiness, that our love had not withstood the strain of that winter. A flaw had appeared, she said. Through all those months I had kept writing verse to her, for her, about her, 2 or 3 poems per week. In the spring of 1916 I published a collection of them, and was horrified when she drew my attention to something I had not noticed at all when concocting the book. There it was, the same ominous flaw, the banal, hollow note, and glib suggestion that our love was doomed since it could never recapture the miracle of its initial moments, the rustle and rush of those limes in the rain, the compassion of the wild countryside. Moreover, but this neither of us saw at the time, my poems were juvenile stuff, quite devoid of merit and ought never to have been put on sale. The book, a copy of which still exists, alas, in the closed stacks of the Lenin Library, Moscow, deserved what it got at the tearing claws of the few critics who noticed it in obscure periodicals. My Russian literature teacher at school, Vladimir Hippius, a first-rate though somewhat esoteric poet whom I greatly admired, he surpassed in talent, I think, his much better-known cousin, Zinaida Hippius, woman poet and critic, brought a copy with him to class and provoked the delirious hilarity of the majority of my classmates by applying his fiery sarcasm, he was a fierce man with red hair, to my most romantic lines. His famous cousin, at a session of the Literary Fund, asked my father, its president, to tell me, please, that I would never, never be a writer. A well-meaning, needy, and talentless journalist, who had reasons to be grateful to my father, wrote an impossibly enthusiastic piece about me, some 500 lines dripping with fulsome praise. It was intercepted in time by my father, and I remember him and me, while we read it in manuscript, grinding our teeth and groaning, the ritual adopted by our family when faced by something in awful taste or by somebody's gaffe. The whole business cured me permanently of all interest in literary fame, and was probably the cause of that almost pathological and not always justified indifference to reviews, which in later years deprived me of the emotions most authors are said to experience. That spring of 1916 is the one I see as the very type of a St. Petersburg spring, when I recall such specific images as Tamara wearing an unfamiliar white hat among the spectators of a hard-fought interscholastic soccer game, in which that Sunday the most sparkling luck helped me to make save after save in goal. And a Camberwell beauty, exactly as old as our romance, sunning its bruised black wings, their borders now bleached by hibernation, on the back of a bench in Alexandrovsky Garden. And the booming of cathedral bells in the keen air, above the corrugated dark blue of the Neva, voluptuously free of ice. And the fair in the confetti-studded slush of the House Guard Boulevard during Katkin Week, with its squeaking and popping din, its wooden toys, its loud hawking of Turkish delight and Cartesian devils called Amerikanski Jiteli, American inhabitants. Minute goblins of glass riding up and down in glass tubes filled with pink or lilac-tinted alcohol, as real Americans do, though all the epithet meant was outlandish, in the shafts of transparent skyscrapers as the office lights go out in the greenish sky. The excitement in the streets made one drunk with desire for the woods and the fields. Tamara and I were especially eager to return to our old haunts, but all through April her mother kept wavering between renting the same cottage again and economically staying in town. finally, under a certain condition, accepted by Tamara with the fortitude of Hans Andersen's Little Mermaid, the cottage was rented, and a glorious summer immediately enveloped us. And there she was, my happy Tamara, on the points of her toes, trying to pull down a racemosa branch in order to pick its puckered fruit, with all the world and its trees wheeling in the orb of her laughing eye, and a dark patch from her exertions in the sun forming under her raised arm in the raw shantung of her yellow frock. We lost ourselves in mossy woods, and bathed in a fairy tale cove, and swore eternal love by the crowns of flowers that, like all little Russian mermaids, she was so fond of weaving, and early in the fall she moved to town in search of a job. This was the condition set by her mother, and in the course of the following months I did not see her at all, engrossed as I was in the kind of varied experience which I thought an elegant littérateur should seek. I had already entered an extravagant phase of sentiment and sensuality that was to last about 10 years. In looking at it from my present tower, I see myself as 100 different young men at once, all pursuing one changeful girl in a series of simultaneous or overlapping love affairs, some delightful, some sordid, that ranged from one-night adventures to protracted involvements and dissimulations with very meager artistic results. Not only is the experience in question, and the shadow of all those charming ladies useless to me now in recomposing my past, but it creates a bothersome defocalization, and no matter how I worry the screws of memory, I cannot recall the way Tamara and I parted. There is possibly another reason, too, for this blurring. We had parted too many times before. During that last summer in the country, we used to part forever after each secret meeting, when in the fluid blackness of the night on that old wooden bridge between masked moon and misty river, I would kiss her warm, wet eyelids and rain-chilled face, and immediately after go back to her for yet another farewell, and then the long, dark, wobbly uphill ride, my slow, laboriously pedaling feet trying to press down the monstrously strong and resilient darkness that refused to stay under. I do remember, however, with heartbreaking vividness, a certain evening in the summer of 1917, when, after a winter of incomprehensible separation, I chanced to meet Tamara on a suburban train. For a few minutes between two stops in the vestibule of a rocking and rasping car, we stood next to each other. I in a state of intense embarrassment, of crushing regret, she consuming a bar of chocolate, methodically breaking off small hard bits of the stuff, and talking of the office where she worked. On one side of the tracks, above bluish bogs, the dark smoke of burning peat was mingling with the smoldering wreck of a huge amber sunset. It can be proved, I think, by published records, that Alexander Bloch was even then noting in his diary the very peat smoke I saw and the wrecked sky. There was later a period in my life when I might have found this relevant to my last glimpse of Tamara as she turned on the steps to look back at me before descending into the jasmine-scented, cricket-mad dusk of a small station. But today, no alien marginalia can dim the purity of the pain. 3. When at the end of the year Lenin took over, the Bolsheviks immediately subordinated everything to the retention of power, and a regime of bloodshed, concentration camps, and hostages entered upon its stupendous career. At the time, many believed one could fight Lenin's gang and save the achievements of the March Revolution. My father, who had been elected to the Constituent Assembly, which in its preliminary phase strove to prevent the entrenchment of the Soviets, decided to remain as long as possible in St. Petersburg, but to send his large family to the Crimea, a region that was still free. This freedom was to last for only a few weeks longer. We traveled in two parties, my brother and I going separately from my mother and the three younger children. The Soviet era was a dull week old. Liberal newspapers still came out, and while seeing us off at the Nikolaevsky station and waiting with us, my imperturbable father settled down at a corner table in the buffet to write in his flowing celestial hand, as the typesetter said, marveling at the absence of corrections, a leading article for the moribund wretch, or perhaps some emergency publication on those special long strips of ruled paper, which correspond proportionally to columns of print. As far as I remember, the main reason for sending my brother and me off so promptly was the probability of our being inducted into the new Red Army if we stayed in town. I was annoyed at going to a fascinating region in mid-November, long after the collecting season was over, having never been very good at digging for pupae, though eventually I did turn up a few beneath a big oak in our Crimean garden. Annoyance changed to distress when, after making a precise little cross over the face of each of us, my father rather casually added that very possibly, Vesma Vosmorzhno, he would never see us again. Whereupon, in trench coat and khaki cap, with his briefcase under his arm, he strode away into the steamy fog. The long journey southward started tolerably well, with the heat still humming and the lamps still intact in the Petrograd Simferopol first-class sleeper, and a passably famous singer in dramatic makeup with a bouquet of chrysanthemums in brown paper pressed to her breast stood in the corridor, tapping upon the pane, along which somebody walked and waved as the train started to glide, without one jolt to indicate we were leaving that gray city forever. But soon after Moscow, all comfort came to an end. At several points of our slow, dreary progression, the train, including our sleeping car, was invaded by more or less Bolshevized soldiers who were returning to their homes from the front. One called them either deserters or red heroes, depending upon one's political views. My brother and I thought it rather fun to lock ourselves up in our compartment and thwart every attempt to disturb us. Several soldiers traveling on the roof of the car added to the sport by trying to use, not unsuccessfully, the ventilator of our room as a toilet. My brother, who was a first-rate actor, managed to simulate all the symptoms of a bad case of typhus, and this helped us out when the door finally gave way. Early on the third morning, at a vague stop, I took advantage of a lull in those merry proceedings to get a breath of fresh air. I moved gingerly along the crowded corridor, stepping over the bodies of snoring men, and got off. A milky mist hung over the platform of an anonymous station. We were somewhere not far from Kharkov. I wore spats and a derby. The cane I carried, a collector's item that had belonged to my uncle Ruka, was of a light-colored, beautifully freckled wood, and the knob was a smooth pink globe of coral cupped in a gold coronet. Had I been one of the tragic bums who lurked in the midst of that station platform where a brittle young fop was pacing back and forth, I would not have withstood the temptation to destroy him. As I was about to board the train, it gave a jerk and started to move. My foot slipped, and my cane was sent flying under the wheels. I had no special affection for the thing. In fact, I carelessly lost it a few years later. But I was being watched, and the fire of adolescent amour propre prompted me to do what I cannot imagine my present self ever doing. I waited for 1, 2, 3, 4 cars to pass. Russian trains were notoriously slow in gaining momentum. And when at last the rails were revealed, I picked up my cane from between them and raced after the nightmarishly receding bumpers. A sturdy proletarian arm conformed to the rules of sentimental fiction, rather than to those of Marxism, by helping me to swarm up. Had I been left behind, those rules might still have held good, since I would have been brought near Tamara, who by that time had also moved south, and was living in a Ukrainian hamlet less than 100 miles from the scene of that ridiculous occurrence. 4. Of her whereabouts I learned unexpectedly a month or so after my arrival in southern Crimea. My family settled in the vicinity of Yalta, at Gaspra, near the village of Kores. The whole place seemed completely foreign. The smells were not Russian, the sounds were not Russian. The donkey braying every evening just as the muezzin started to chant from the village minaret, a slim blue tower silhouetted against the peach-colored sky, was positively Baghdadian. And there was I, standing on a chalky bridle path near a chalky stream bed where separate serpent-like bands of water thinly glided over oval stones. There was I, holding a letter from Tamara. I looked up at the abrupt Yaila Mountains, covered up to their rocky brows with the caracul of the dark tauric pine, at the maquis-like stretch of evergreen vegetation between mountain and sea, at the translucent pink sky, where a self-conscious crescent shone with a single humid star near it. And the whole artificial scene struck me as something in a prettily illustrated, albeit sadly abridged, edition of the Arabian Nights. Suddenly I felt all the pangs of exile. There had been the case of Pushkin, of course. Pushkin, who had wandered in banishment here among those naturalized cypresses and laurels, but though some prompting might have come from his elegies, I do not think my exaltation was a pose. Thenceforth, for several years, until the writing of a novel relieved me of that fertile emotion, the loss of my country was equated for me with the loss of my love. Meanwhile, the life of my family had completely changed. Except for a few jewels astutely buried in the normal filling of a talcum powder container, we were absolutely ruined. But this was a very minor matter. The local Tatar government had been swept away by a brand new Soviet, and we were subjected to the preposterous and humiliating sense of utter insecurity. During the winter of 1917-18, and well into the windy and bright Crimean spring, idiotic death toddled by our side. Every other day on the White Yalta Pier, where, as you remember, the lady of Chekhov's Lady with the Lapdog lost her lorgnette among the vacational crowd, various harmless people had in advance weights attached to their feet and then were shot by tough Bolshevik sailors imported from Sebastopol for the purpose. My father, who was not harmless, had joined us by this time, after some dangerous adventures, and in that region of lung specialists had adopted the mimetic disguise of a doctor without changing his name, simple and elegant, as a chess annotator would have said of a corresponding move on the board. We dwelt in an inconspicuous villa that a kind friend, Countess Sofia Panin, had placed at our disposal. On certain nights, when rumors of nearing assassins were especially strong, the men of our family took turns patrolling the house. The slender shadows of oleander leaves would cautiously move in the sea breeze along a pale wall, as if pointing at something with a great show of stealth. We had a shotgun and a Belgian automatic, and did our best to pooh-pooh the decree which said that anyone unlawfully possessing firearms would be executed on the spot. Chance treated us kindly. Nothing happened beyond the shock we got in the middle of a January night, when a brigand-like figure, all swathed in leather and fur, crept into our midst. But it turned out to be only our former chauffeur, Tsiganov, who had thought nothing of riding all the way from St. Petersburg, on buffers and in freight cars, through the immense, frosty, and savage expanse of Russia, for the mere purpose of bringing us a very welcome sum of money, unexpectedly sent us by some good friends of ours. He also brought the mail received at our St. Petersburg address. Among it was that letter from Tamara. After a month's stay, Tsiganov declared the Crimean scenery bored him, and departed, to go all the way back north with a big bag over his shoulder, containing various articles which we would have gladly given him had we thought he coveted them, such as a trouser press, tennis shoes, nightshirts, an alarm clock, a flat iron, several other ridiculous things I have forgotten, and the absence of which only gradually came to light, if not pointed out with vindictive zeal by an anemic servant girl whose pale charms he had also rifled. Curiously enough, he had prevailed upon us to transfer my mother's precious stones from the talcum powder container that he had at once detected to a hole dug in the garden under a versatile oak, and there they all were after his departure. Then, one spring day in 1918, when the pink puffs of blossoming almond trees enlivened the dark mountainside, the Bolsheviks vanished, and a singularly silent army of Germans replaced them. Patriotic Russians were torn between the animal relief of escaping native executioners and the necessity of owing their reprieve to a foreign invader, especially to the Germans. The latter, however, were losing their war in the West and came to Yalta on tiptoe with diffident smiles, an army of gray apparitions easy for a patriot to ignore. And ignored it was, save for some rather ungrateful snickers at the half-hearted keep-off-the-grass signs that appeared on park lawns. A couple of months later, having nicely repaired the plumbing in various villas vacated by commissars, the Germans faded out in their turn. The whites trickled in from the east, and soon began fighting the Red Army, which was attacking the Crimea from the north. My father became Minister of Justice in the regional government located in Simferopol, and his family was lodged near Yalta on the Livadia grounds, the Tsar's former domain. A brash, hectic gaiety associated with white-held towns brought back, in a vulgarized version, the amenities of peaceful years. Cafes did a wonderful business. All kinds of theaters thrived. One morning on a mountain trail, I suddenly met a strange cavalier clad in a Circassian costume, with a tense, perspiring face painted a fantastic yellow. He kept furiously tugging at his horse, which, without heeding him, proceeded down the steep path at a curiously purposeful walk, like that of an offended person leaving a party. I had seen runaway horses, but I had never seen a walkaway one before, and my astonishment was given a still more pleasurable edge when I recognized the unfortunate rider as Mozhurin, whom Tamara and I had so often admired on the screen. The film Haji Murad, after Tolstoy's tale of that gallant rough-riding mountain chief, was being rehearsed on the mountain pastures of the range. "Stop that brute,"